All right, let's look at Judges chapter 10. And as we finished up last time, we saw that one of Gideon's sons, Abimelech, had slain his 70 brothers, all except one, Jotham, who had fled. And this man, Abimelech, with the assistance of the people of Shechem, where his mother was from, had managed to kill his siblings and eliminate all rivalry for the rule. Not that there should have been any rivalry for rule anyway, since Gideon was not a king and his sons did not intrinsically have any authority. But since the people had, in fact, wanted to make Gideon a king. You might remember in chapter 8, the people had said to Gideon, you rule over us and your son rule over us and your son's son. Gideon had turned down that offer, but obviously the people were getting to a place where they were of a mind to want to have a hereditary rulership, a hereditary dynasty of kings. It was not quite the case that they adopted it, and that didn't happen until the time of Samuel. But they were thinking along those lines, so it was probably easy after Gideon had judged for so long that when he died, one of his sons, already having become an important person in the lifetime of his father, could just keep the momentum going and claim special things for himself. And some of the people were of a mind to go ahead and go along with it. But he came to a bad end because God was against him, and he caused the people of Shechem, who were first his supporters, to become against him and to wage war against him. And he was killed actually as he was besieging a tower, and a woman dropped a millstone on his head and cracked his skull. He was only conscious enough to realize that he was going to die at the hands of a woman unless something else was done, so he had his arm bearer kill him with a sword. And that's how he died, with a cracked skull and a sword through his heart. Now, in chapter 10, we do not yet have an introduction of a major judge. We have what most commentators would call minor judges. There are several minor judges as well as the major ones. The next major judge is going to be Jephthah. And I guess they refer to them as major judges simply because of the fact that we have much more information about them. They're not really more important necessarily than the others. For example, we're going to read about Tola, and he judged Israel for 23 years, and Jair judged Israel for 22 years. Both of these men judged Israel longer than Jephthah did, as we shall see. But Jephthah had more information about him, and so he's a bigger personality in the story. But we know very little about Tola or Jair. We're told in verse 1 and 2 of chapter 10, after Abimelech, there arose to save Israel Tola, the son of Puah, the son of Dodo, a man of Issachar. And he dwelt in Shamir in the mountains of Ephraim. He judged Israel 23 years, and he died and was buried in Shamir. Now, this is all we know about the man, and we don't even know where Shamir is. It's an unidentified place. So we don't know where he lived, where he died, where he was buried. We know who his ancestors were, going back a couple of generations. But even then, they are unknown men to us. So the man is pretty much as obscure as he can be. He's of the tribe of Issachar and lived in the mountains of Ephraim. And he somehow saved Israel. We're not told what he saved them from. In many of the cases, we read that the people displeased God, did evil in the sight of the Lord, and God brought some invading army in to oppress them for a certain number of years. And then when the people would cry out to God, he would raise up a judge to deliver them and to judge them for the rest of his lifetime. Here, though, we only read that he saved Israel. We don't read about them having returned to doing evil, although perhaps they had never stopped. During the time of Abimelech, it was a pretty evil time. Abimelech was an evil man. They were worshiping Baal in Shechem. So it may be that they didn't have to do evil in the sight of the Lord again in order for them to need to be delivered. But what form the oppression took, we're not told. We don't know whether he actually led them in war against some oppressors, as many of their judges did, like Gideon did and others, or whether he just kind of rose up at a time when people were ready to listen and he stood for God and judge them according to God's laws. There's just too little said about him, so we have to move along without saying much more. Now, Jair, we don't know very much more than that about. We know a little more. After this man rose, Jair, a Gileadite. Now, Gilead was on the east side of the Jordan in the realm of Manasseh, the half tribe of Manasseh that was on the east of Jordan. Jephthah was from there as well. He was a Gileadite, and he judged Israel 22 years. So together, these men judged Israel for 45 years and would appear to have represented a period of 45 years of relative peace under the leadership of these two men. Now, he had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys, and they also had 30 towns. He had 30 sons. That's a lot of sons, so he probably had multiple wives to produce such large numbers of offspring. And they rode on 30 donkeys, which means that all of them were like chiefs. A donkey was an unusual thing to ride on. Most people walked. Men who rode donkeys regularly were like men who have fancy transportation today. You might say of someone today, he had 30 sons and they all drove Mercedes or they all drove BMWs or something like that. Probably it means that they were chiefs of some kind. We might begin to see a little bit of what was happening with Gideon. Gideon was a judge. And his sons, at least one of them, begins to think of himself as a ruler. And maybe Israel's mentality was moving that direction more so that the judges, you know, their sons were beginning to be big men too. And they not only rode on 30 donkeys, but they also had 30 towns, which are called Havoth Jair, which means the towns of Jair, to this day, which are in the land of Gilead. It says, and Jair died and was buried in Kamon. And so nothing more is known of him, except that he judged Israel for 22 years, and his sons began to exercise hold some kind of position, also in certain cities, in 30 cities. Now, there's a bit of confusion about this Havoth Jair, because it sounds as if these 30 cities or towns were named after this man, Jair. However, there was an earlier man named Jair in Gilead, back in the days of Moses, and the towns were named that back then. They're called Havoth Jair. You can see this, for example, if you go back to Numbers chapter 32 and verse 41. Numbers 32:41 says, also Jair, the son of Manasseh, went and took its small towns and called them Havoth Jair. And this was in the days of Moses, apparently. Back when they first conquered that region from Sion and Og, this particular Manassite conquered these towns. His name was Jair, and they were called Havoth Jair. So it doesn't sound like they were so named as a result of this later man, this later judge named Jair. We have the same information in Deuteronomy 3:14. It says, Jair, the son of Manasseh, took all the region of Argob as far as the border of Geshurites and the Maacathites and called Bashan after his own name, Havoth Jair, to this day. So it's the same information from Numbers that in the days of Moses, there were cities, it doesn't say how many, that were called Havoth Jair. Now, at a later time, we read in 1 Kings 4:13 that there were 60 such cities. 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 13, it says, Ben-Geber in Ramoth-Gilead, which is over there in that region of Gilead, to him belonged the towns of Jair, the son of Manasseh, in Gilead. To him also belonged the region of Argob in Bashan, 60 large cities with walls of bronze gate bars. The region of Argob in Bashan was also called Havoth Jair, according to Deuteronomy chapter 3, verse 14. So here we read of 60 large cities, and that is the number 60 is also confirmed in the parallel in 1 Chronicles 2:23, that there were 60 cities that were named after this man Jair, not this man that we're reading right here, but an earlier Jair of the same tribe in the same region. And they were conquered from the pagans that lived on that side of the region by this earlier Jair. And these 60 cities were named after him. Now, what do we make of this then? In chapter 10 of Judges, verse 4, now he had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys who also had 30 towns, which are called Havoth Jair to this day. Well, the 30 towns they had were apparently 30 of the 60. There were only 30 of these sons, so they apparently oversaw or had some position of authority in 30 of the 60 towns of Jair. 30 of the 60 nurses, of those that are called that to this day, they had 30 of them. And it's just a coincidence that their father had the same name as the earlier man who had conquered those cities. Maybe coincidence, maybe not. I mean, their father was probably named after that ancestor of theirs. But he came to prominence, and his sons came to prominence in those towns. Verse 6, it says, "Then the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, and served the Baals and the Ashtoreths, the gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the people of Ammon, and the gods of the Philistines, and they forsook the Lord and did not serve him. So the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the people of Ammon." Now these two enemies were, in the latter part of the period of Judges, the worst enemies of Israel. And one of the major judges that rose up came against the Ammonites, and that was Jephthah. And the other one came against the Philistines, and that was, of course, Samson. Samson, if he had been somewhat more disciplined and more godly, might have fully eradicated the Philistine threat, but because of his foolishness, he got himself into trouble and died prematurely. Killed a lot of Philistines in the process, but he did not fully deliver Israel from the Philistines, and later Samuel did, as we shall see in the book of 1 Samuel. These two, the Philistines and the Ammonites, the people of Ammon, were the main ones that God delivered them into the hands of at this later period. From that year, they harassed and oppressed the children of Israel for 18 years, all the children of Israel who were on the other side of the Jordan in the land of the Amorites in Gilead. And of course, that's where Jephthah's going to rise up. Moreover, the people of Ammon crossed over the Jordan to fight against Judah, also against Benjamin, and against the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was severely distressed. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, saying, "We have sinned against you, because we have forsaken our God and served the Baals." So the Lord said to the children of Israel, "Did I not deliver you from the Egyptians," meaning in the Exodus, "and from the Amorites and from the people of Ammon, and from the Philistines," which he had partially done through earlier deliverances? Remember, Shamgar had killed off a bunch of Philistines, and the Amorites and the Ammonites were involved in some of the other attacks that had come against Israel before. "Also the Sidonians and the Amalekites and the Maonites." Now the Maonites, actually we've not read of them previous to this, the others we have, but the Maonites, the Septuagint says Midianites. And that might preserve the original reading. It's possible that the Hebrew text has had a mistake entered, because the Septuagint says Midianites, and we know that they were the ones that Gideon was used to deliver Israel from. So it may be that that's the better reading. "They oppressed you, and you cried out to me, and I delivered you from their hand. Yet you have forsaken me and served other gods. Therefore I will deliver you no more. Go and cry out to the gods which you have chosen. Let them deliver you in your time of distress." Now, it sounds like this is the end of the book of Judges, because God says, "I'm not going to deliver you anymore. No more judges, no more deliverance." But he changed his mind. And it's really important that we note this about God, because there are some things that people today think must be permanent arrangements, because in the Old Testament, God says, "I'll never do this again," or "I'm not going to do that anymore." And in fact, what he's really waiting to be persuaded otherwise. He's basically saying, "Okay, I'm done with you." But he can be persuaded. And so we see, for example, that he told Moses he was going to wipe out Israel and make a greater nation out of Moses. And yet he allowed Moses to prevail with him in intercession and change his mind. So here he says, "Okay, as things stand, I'm not going to do any more for you. I've already delivered you again and again. And you never served me. And therefore, why should I keep helping you? I'm not going to do that anymore." It says, "Then the children of Israel said to the Lord, 'We have sinned. Do to us whatever seems best to you. Only deliver us this day, we pray.' So they put away the foreign gods from among them and served Yahweh. And his soul could no longer endure the misery of Israel." So in this case, they actually repented and put away the gods before there was any promise of deliverance. In fact, God had said he wasn't going to deliver them. But they took their chance and they thought, "Well, we're going to turn to God anyway. And even though he said he's not going to deliver us, we're done with these false gods," which was good. And God noticed that, and his soul could no longer endure the misery of Israel. He's sympathetic toward them. Then the people of Ammon gathered together and encamped in Gilead. And the children of Israel assembled together and encamped in Mizpah. And the people, the leaders of Gilead, said to one another, "Who is the man who will begin to fight against the people of Ammon? He shall be the head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." Now here they're looking for a leader. In the other cases, God raised up a leader. They didn't have to go looking for one. The man, God called him. But here, God has said to them, "I'm not going to deliver you anymore." But they're saying, "Well, we're going to fight our enemies off anyway." And so they put away their false gods, and they got together at Mizpah to actually mobilize against Ammon. Now, this is something that didn't happen usually without a judge rising up. Usually the people of Israel were under their oppressors until some judge came and said, "Come on, let's go fight them," and then they'd get together. Here, this seems to be almost a consensus of the tribes that it's no longer going to be acceptable to put up with this Ammonite oppression. So we're just going to come to God, and if he doesn't promise to give us the victory, we're going to fight anyway. And he hasn't promised. He said he's not going to deliver us, but we're just going to go ahead and engage in battle. He hasn't raised up a judge, but we need a leader. Who shall we have leading us against Ammon? So this looks like a human enterprise. It almost seems a little bit like when Israel had heard the bad report from the spies in the book of Numbers and had rebelled and said, "We're not going to go in the land." And then Moses said, "Well, then God says, you're going to die in the wilderness. You're going to wander for another 38 years until you're all dead and your children are going to the land." Well, the people said, "Oh, no, well, we'll go in now." And Moses said, "No, God's not going to deliver you." They said, "Oh, no, we'll go take the land now." And they went in and they got defeated because God wasn't with them. And it looks like the same situation here, except for the fact that at the end of verse 16, we're told that God's soul could no longer endure the misery of Israel. He had said he wouldn't help them anymore, but that wasn't his final word. He saw that they were putting away their false gods. He saw that their repentance appeared to be almost unconditional, because now they were going to serve God, even though he said he's not going to deliver them. They're going to serve him anyway. And so he pitied them. And even though he didn't raise up this judge, at least not in the ordinary sense, but they went and picked him, God apparently put his blessing on it, because Jephthah was said to judge Israel. He was one of the judges. And so this happened a little differently than in the previous cases. This was the people initiating something rather than God initiating the raising up of a judge. They are saying, "Okay, who are we going to find to lead us into battle?" And in verse 6, we read that they came to Jephthah. That is chapter 11. But in verses 1 through 5, we have to be introduced to Jephthah. So we kind of take time out to get a little background of Jephthah. Because at the end of chapter 10, they're trying to decide who to go to. And in chapter 11, verse 6, they select Jephthah. But we wouldn't know who Jephthah was if we didn't have verses 1 through 5. So a little parenthesis given here to give the background of this man. It says, "Now Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty man of valor, but he was the son of a harlot, and Gilead begot Jephthah. Gilead's wife bore sons, and when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out and said to him, 'You shall have no inheritance in our father's house, for you are a son of another woman.' Then Jephthah fled from his brothers and dwelt in the land of Tob. And worthless men banded together with Jephthah and went out raiding with him." Now, it doesn't say who they were raiding, but it would appear they were raiding the Ammonites. The Ammonites were oppressing their people, so he became almost like the Maccabeans at a later time when the Syrians were oppressing Israel in the time of the Maccabeans in the 2nd century B.C. This family rose up to wage guerrilla warfare against them, to run raids against them, and eventually drove them out. Apparently, Jephthah, having been rejected by his brothers, decided that he'd just go out and on his own pick on the enemies. And he had some worthless fellows who went with him. Now, the fact that the fellows who went with him were worthless might make it sound like he was a bad guy and that they were bad guys. And that's actually how many commentators depict him. They depict him to be kind of a bad man and a foolish man. Even the vow that he makes that's so controversial, they see it as a foolish vow that he makes. There certainly is a different way to read that. As I read the story, I'm getting a different impression of him. I see him as a devout man, but he's wrongfully persecuted by his brothers just because of who his mother was. He had no say about that. He was driven out of his home, so He decided to make himself useful. There were other people who apparently had been driven out of normal society, and so he became their leader, and they decided to do some things to help deliver their people. And he was apparently running raids against the Ammonites already, and that's why he got chosen to be the leader of Israel. So they knew about him. He was an outlaw, no doubt, in the sight of the Ammonites. But so was David when he had 400 men following him. The very same thing is said about David at a certain period of his life. He is declared to be, in chapter 16 of 1 Samuel, a mighty man of valor. That's what we're told about Jephthah here. He's a mighty man of valor, verse 1 says. And we are told in 1 Samuel chapter 22 that the people who followed David when he was fleeing from Saul and living in the wilderness, here's how they're described in 1 Samuel 22:2. Everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him. So he became captain over them, and there were about 400 men with him. That's how David is described at the time before he actually becomes king, and when he's being persecuted by the existing king Saul. David's a mighty man of valor. He's got sort of the people who have debts to pay they can't pay, and people are distressed, people who are discontented, people who are kind of outcasts from society for whatever reason. They join with him, and he becomes a leader, and they actually do military exploits against the Philistines. David does. Now, apparently, Jephthah was doing something quite similar. Like David had been driven out of his land by Saul for no good reason, Jephthah had been driven out of his town by his brothers for no good reason, because they didn't want to share the inheritance with him because he had a different mother than them. And so it seems like Jephthah found himself living out in the wilderness by no choice of his own. He was driven out of town by his brothers. And he found a way to make himself useful. And it seems to me that the man is unusually godly for the period. When he actually sends a message to the Ammonites, he seems very literate. He seems to know that he knows the Pentateuch very well. He can recite the history of the book of Judges quite accurately. So he seems to be a man who knew the scriptures, which very few people probably paid any attention to back then. He seemed to be a man who was on the side of his country, a man who made the best of a bad situation when he was driven out of his town. So, verse 4 says, "Now it came to pass after a time that the people of Ammon made war against Israel." That's picking up where we left off at the end of chapter 10, and ramping up to resume that narrative. "So it was, when the people of Ammon made war against Israel, that the elders of Gilead went to get Jephthah from the land Tob. Then they said to Jephthah, 'Come and be our commander, that we might fight against the people of Ammon.'" Now, he already had some people that he was commander over, his band of brigands, but now his whole tribe really wants to stand behind him and back him up and fight under his leadership against the Ammonites. "So Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, 'Did you not hate me and expel me from my father's house? Why have you come to me now when you are in distress?' And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, 'That is why we have turned against you now, that you may go with us and fight against the people of Ammon and be our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead.'" In other words, because we are in distress. Now, he could have, if he was a worse man, he could say, "You take care of yourselves. You drove me out when things were good for you. And now things are bad for you. Well, deal with it. You know, I'm doing okay on my own. I don't need to take on your problems. And I don't have any debt to you people." But Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, "If you take me back home to fight against the people of Ammon, and the Lord delivers them to me, shall I be your head?" And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, "The Lord will be a witness between us if we do not do according to your words." So he says, okay, what's going to be the outcome if I actually lead you people to victory? Will it be like when Gideon did? Or will it be like when Othniel did? Will I be then the judge in the land? They said yes, and they took an oath about that. "Then Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and commander over them. And Jephthah spoke all his words before the Lord in Mizpah." Now, here, this is why I think that Jephthah is supposed to be seen as a godly man. All these words he spoke before Yahweh. Now, what's that mean? Of course, all things are done before Yahweh, because Yahweh is everywhere, but that's not worth mentioning. He consciously said these words in the presence of God. in Mizpah, anyway, it specifically says that Jephthah was making his negotiations consciously in the presence of the Lord. That is, he was acknowledging the Lord in the matter and considering the Lord as opposed to just making his decisions from a strictly secular frame of mind. Now, Jephthah sent messengers to the king of the people of Ammon, saying, "What do you have against me that you have come to fight against me in my land?" And the king of the people of Ammon answered the messengers of Jephthah, "Because Israel took away my land when they came out of Egypt, from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok, and to the Jordan. Now therefore restore those lands peaceably." So basically, the Ammonites wanted to recover land that had been captured 300 years earlier, when the Israelites had come out of Egypt. Now, it's not quite true that Israel took the land of the Ammonites. When they came through that region, God specifically forbade them from fighting against the Ammonites and the Moabites because they were brother nations of a sort, more like distant cousins. The Ammonites and the Moabites were the descendants of Lot, and Lot was Abraham's nephew. Israel, of course, came from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abram's nephew is more remotely related to them, and his two sons were born, remember, from his two daughters. In the cave, when he fled from Sodom and Gomorrah, that's when Ammon and Moab came to be. And these were their descendants. So when Israel came out of Egypt, God said, "Don't fight against the Ammonites, don't fight against the Moabites, leave them alone, don't molest them. They are your brothers, leave them alone." So although neither the Moabites nor the Ammonites were friendly toward Israel, Israel didn't attack them, and instead made war against the Amorites, who were Canaanites on the east side of the Jordan. But what had happened was that at some point in that time, Sihon, the Amorite king, had taken land from the Ammonites. And therefore, land that had been Ammonite land came to be under the Amorite king, Sihon. And he was defeated by Israel, and the land was taken by Israel. So Israel did not directly take any land from the Ammonites. It had been lost by them to another king. And then Israel conquered that other king and inherited his land. That's just how land boundaries end up shifting. If China would invade and overrun and take over America, Native American Indians wouldn't be able to blame China for the fact that, you know, their land was taken from them by Europeans from hundreds of years earlier. That wouldn't make sense. And that's kind of what the Ammonites were doing. They're like Native Americans trying to get the land back from China if China would take it from us. You know, we've had it for 300 years or however long it's been. Israel had had this land for that long and had not taken it from the Ammonites. It had at some earlier time belonged to them, but almost all land anywhere at one time or another belonged to somebody else at an earlier time. It's not the same thing as being able to accuse Israel of having attacked them and wronged them. So that's how the Ammonites responded. But as I say, Jephthah showed tremendous knowledge of the background of the land and the history of Israel and stuff that he would have gotten from reading the book of Numbers, or at least being familiar with it. Verse 14, Jephthah again sent messengers to the king of the people of Ammon and said to him, "Thus says Jephthah, Israel did not take away the land of Moab, nor the land of the people of Ammon. For when Israel came up from Egypt, they walked through the wilderness as far as the Red Sea and came to Kadesh. Then Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom, saying, 'Please let me pass through your land.' But the king of Edom would not heed. And in like manner, they sent to the king of Moab, and he would not consent. So Israel remained in Kadesh. And they went along through the wilderness and bypassed the land of Edom and the land of Moab and came to the east side of the land of Moab and encamped on the other side of the Arnon. But they did not enter the border of Moab, for the Arnon was the border of Moab. Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, king of Heshbon. And Israel said to him, 'Please let us pass through your land into our place.' But Sihon did not trust Israel to pass through his territory. So Sihon gathered all his people together, encamped in Jahaz, and fought against Israel. And the Lord God of Israel delivered Sihon and all his people into the hand of Israel, and they defeated them. Thus Israel gained possession of all the land of the Amorites who inhabited that country. They took possession of all the territory of the Amorites, from the Arnon to the Jabbok, and from the wilderness to the Jordan. So now the Lord God, Yahweh, God of Israel, has dispossessed the Amorites from before his people, Israel. Should you then possess it? Will you not possess whatever Chemosh, your God, gives you to possess? So whatever Yahweh, our God, takes possession of before us, we will possess. He's saying, you know, we weren't the aggressors against you guys. We fought the Amorites. And for us, reading this, Amorites, Ammonites, it all sounds kind of similar, but it's very different because the Ammonites were related to the Moabites, who were related more distantly to Israel, where the Amorites were the Canaanites that had to be wiped out. And so the Amorites had taken land earlier that had been apparently Ammonite land. And he said, we didn't take it from you, we took it from the Amorites. And then he says, our God gave it to us. Why don't you take the land that your God gives to you? If you've got a God who can give you something, let him do it. And he says, verse 25, and now, are you any better than Balak, the son of Zippor, the king of Moab? Did he ever strive against Israel? Did he ever fight against them? That is, Balak actually was afraid to fight against them, and he's the one who hired Balaam to curse them. But what he's saying is, Balak never came to us and said, you know, that Amorite land you guys have taken, that used to be mine, as apparently some of it had been, and so you should give it back to us. He says, Balak never made that kind of a claim. You know, he knew that he'd lost the land fairly and squarely to the Amorites, and we got it from them, not from him. Did he ever strive against Israel? Did he ever fight against them? While Israel dwelt in Heshbon and its villages, in Aroer and its villages, and in all the cities along the banks of the Arnon for 300 years, why did you not recover them within that time? In other words, if we've been here for 300 years, it's hard to imagine anything more than that that could give people the basis for claiming that this is their territory. You know, we've been here for 300 years. You never took it back during that time, never even tried. So, you know, how can you claim it's your land? It's been ours for 300 years, and you've never disputed that. Therefore, I have not sinned against you, but you wronged me by fighting against me. May Yahweh, the judge, render judgment this day between the children of Israel and the people of Ammon. However, the king of the people of Ammon did not heed the words of Jephthah, which he sent him. And so, of course, there's got to be a war. But Jephthah tried to, you know, use diplomacy first. Now, Jephthah was a wild and militant man. He ran, you know, he was accustomed to running raids, and he was a man of valor and so forth. He was a man who was a fighter. But apparently he didn't want to shed blood unnecessarily. He thought he'd try to reason with the Ammonites and say, listen, this is you really don't have any good cause to be here. Why don't you just withdraw and leave us alone? He gave him a chance to retreat. Now, the Ammonites got badly defeated in this battle, but they can't blame anyone but themselves because they were invited to just leave peaceably. And that's exactly what Jephthah was trying to accomplish, is to not war. He wasn't afraid to fight. He was a brave man. He probably was just trying to prevent any unnecessary bloodshed. So attempting diplomacy first was wise, and the degree to which he was able to recount Israel's history and how God had spoken to them and so forth would be something that a man wouldn't know intuitively. They didn't have public schools to teach history in those days, and there weren't synagogues. He would have to have gotten that strictly from somehow making himself familiar with the Pentateuch, which means that he went out of his way to learn what God had said through Moses, as many people in that time would not bother to do. Verse 29, then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and he passed through Gilead and Manasseh, and passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he advanced toward the people of Ammon. So it was because the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, he was empowered to become aggressive toward the Ammonites. This is later said to be true of King Saul when the Ammonites again, in the time of Saul, were afflicting Gilead and trying to recover it. And news came to Saul about it. It says the Spirit of the Lord came on Saul and he grew very angry, and he mobilized Israel to go out and fight and deliver the people of Gilead again. God's Spirit in those days came upon men to deliver his people through war. And so their generals that God raised up were Spirit-filled men. And when the Spirit came upon somebody in Old Testament times, it wasn't the same as when the Spirit came upon people at Pentecost. The Spirit came on people at Pentecost, the Spirit of God moved into the church as his permanent dwelling place, his house, the temple of the Holy Spirit. People were not the temple of God's Spirit back then. He came upon them and gave them power. but didn't always have a sanctifying effect. You know, Samson's the most unsanctified of the judges that we read about, and yet there's more mention of the Spirit moving on him than of any of the other judges. So we'd have to assume that the work of the Spirit of God in those days was merely empowering, whereas, of course, in the New Testament, the work of the Spirit is also to sanctify. The men of the Old Testament who had the Spirit come upon them may or may not have been sanctified men. The Holy Spirit didn't necessarily have that effect on them in those days. But they were empowered supernaturally by the Spirit. And so in verse 30, as Jephthah is about ready to go to war, he makes a vow. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, "If you will indeed deliver the people of Ammon into my hands, then it will be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the people of Ammon shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering." So Jephthah advanced toward the people of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord delivered them into his hands, and he defeated them from Aroer as far as Minnith, 20 cities, and to Abel-Kiramim with a very great slaughter. Thus the people of Ammon were subdued before the children of Israel. Now, the whole war is covered in two verses' time, in verses 32 and 33. The war must have taken some time, and there must have been interesting features of it, but it's not important for the writer to tell us how the war was won. It's simply that God gave the victory to Jephthah according to Jephthah's request, which was attached to the vow. And there's far more attention given to the fulfillment of the vow than there is to the war itself. Many people think that Jephthah made a hasty vow. In fact, many commentators make him out to have made a foolish vow and even an evil vow, as if he was promising to offer a human sacrifice. Now, it seems very unlikely that Jephthah intended to offer a human sacrifice. When he found out that it was going to be a human being that he had to offer the Lord, it was a grief to him. That was his daughter, of course. But some people think that he had anticipated a human being, but not his daughter coming out of the house. Maybe a servant or something coming out and he'd sacrifice them. This is something we're going to have to discuss as we look at the outcome, because we have now in verses 34 through 40 a description of how he fulfilled his vow. But it's not described in so much detail as to remove all controversy as to what he did. Many people think he sacrificed his daughter as a burnt offering. Others think not. And there are arguments on both sides. But it says in verse 34, "When Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, there was his daughter coming out to meet him with timbrels and dancing, and she was his only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter." Now that's mentioned because it was very important to a man to be able to leave offspring for his name to be perpetuated after his death. It would require that he have a son or at least a daughter. His name would not be perpetuated through a daughter, but his bloodline would in some ways. And yet here she's the only offspring he has. He doesn't have a son, and that in itself is tragic. Just having a daughter, he cannot have his name perpetuated, but at least a daughter can give him grandchildren. And the daughters of Zelophehad had set a precedent that at least daughters could inherit their father's estates if he had no son. So he could leave things to a daughter and to his grandsons, but not if she never had any children. And so this is the tragedy of it. This was his only offspring, and he didn't have any others. "And it came to pass when he saw her that he tore his clothes and said, 'Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low. You are among those who trouble me, for I have given my word to Yahweh, and I cannot go back on it.'" Again, this shows his piety. Most men in that situation say, "Well, that was a dumb thing I offered. I'm not going to do it. You know, God can just deal with it. I'm not going to keep this vow." I've known people who've made less difficult vows to keep who've backed out of them, and they were Christians. I mean, the fact that Jephthah did not see himself, he didn't even have the option that he allowed himself to not keep his vow to the Lord, proves he was a pious man. And he is, of course, remembered in the book of Hebrews as a man of faith. So that doesn't tell us how pious he was, because Samson also is remembered as a man of faith in Hebrews 11. Jephthah, in all points, seems to be a godly man. So he says, "I cannot go back on my vow." So she said to him, "My father, if you have given your word to Yahweh, do to me according to what has gone out of your mouth, because Yahweh has avenged you on your enemies, the people of Ammon." Now that's interesting that she would just say, "Well, whatever you say, you know, you can't go back on the Lord, even if it's at my expense. It reminds me of a story that Richard Wurmbrand told, who had spent 14 years tortured as a pastor in a Romanian communist prison. And he had the stories of many other prisoners who were tortured and so forth. And he said there was a man, I think it was a pastor, tortured in a communist prison, who was holding up well under torture and was not breaking. And so his son was brought in. I don't remember how old his son was. I think around 12 years old. And they began to torture his son in front of him. And the pastor, who had put up well with being tortured himself, just found himself unable to watch his son be tortured like that. And he actually spoke to his son and said, "Son, I can't watch them do this to you. I'm going to have to do what they say. I'm going to have to deny Christ." And his son said, "If you deny Christ, you're no father of mine." And so his son was tortured to death before his eyes. I mean, that's the kind of price that some people have had to pay for their faith in communist countries today. It's hard enough to be tortured to death yourself, but to see your kids tortured to death in front of you would be much harder. But to have a son take that position, you know, you have a commitment to God, you must not deny your commitment to God to spare me. That really is the way that a godly child should think, but very few, I would think, do. Jesus said, "Anyone who loves father or mother or wife or children more than me is not worthy of me." It is true that we can't just deny Christ or violate our obligations to God in order to spare our children. However, it is my opinion that he did not sacrifice his daughter, but fulfilled the vow in another way. So she said to him, "You've got to do what you told the Lord you're going to do." But she also said this in verse 37. Then she said to her father, "Let this thing be done for me. Let me alone for 2 months that I may go and wander in the mountains and bewail my virginity, my friends and I." So he said, "Go." And he sent her away for 2 months, and she went with her friends and bewailed her virginity on the mountains. And it was so at the end of the 2 months that she returned to her father, and he carried out his vow with her, which he had vowed. She knew no man. And it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went 4 days each year to lament the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite. Actually, the word lament means praise in the Hebrew. They went out to praise her. Most people, when they read this, assume that she was offered as a burnt offering, but I think it's not likely the case. When we look at the vow that Jephthah made, which, of course, the wording of it is found in verse 31. He said that if you deliver these people in my hand, then it will be that whatsoever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the people of Ammon shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. Some Hebrew scholars have said that the word "and" can also mean "or." I know this is true in some languages, and I don't know Hebrew well enough, except that some scholars have actually said that, and they do know Hebrew, so I'm going to take their word for it. That the word "and" can also mean "or," depending on context. And if, in fact, he said, "Whatever meets me shall be the Lord's, or I will offer it up as a burnt offering," then he's making two possible options. One is, if it's a human being that meets him, they will be the Lord's. Or, if it's an animal, a clean animal, it'll be offered as a burnt offering. Of course, if a donkey or a dog or a rat came out of his house, he couldn't offer that because that's an unclean animal. Couldn't offer a human either. So that his vow would be essentially, if it is an animal that can be offered as a burnt offering, then that's what I'll do with it. And if it's not, then I'll dedicate it to the Lord. As Samuel was dedicated to the Lord. And there's plenty of evidence in the scripture that both boys and girls could be dedicated to the Lord by their parents. And this would mean that in the case of a girl, she would not marry. Now, in the case of a boy, he might, because a priest could marry. And Samuel was dedicated to the Lord, but he married and had children. But apparently a girl that was dedicated to the Lord would serve as a virgin her whole life in the tabernacle, just doing whatever services had to be done there. Boys and girls would both grow up in the tabernacle if they were dedicated to God, to just be like Levites, really. I mean, Samuel was not a Levite, and yet he did functions as a priest when he was older, probably because one who is dedicated to the Lord to serve in the temple would be essentially the same as a Levite and would apparently just be viewed as having no distinction from a Levite. But in the case of a girl, she's not just like a Levite, because female Levites didn't serve in the tabernacle, but she would be more like a nun, a little bit more like what we think of a nun being in a convent. And so many people believe that she was not sacrificed, and that's not what he promised. What he promised was that he would do one or the other. Given one set of circumstances, I will just dedicate it to the Lord. Now, could you dedicate a donkey to the Lord? Yes, you could. Or you could redeem it with a lamb. Or break its neck under the law. It was the Lord's. The firstborn of a donkey, the firstborn of any animal, was the Lord's. Even the unclean ones. They couldn't be sacrificed, but they could be dedicated to the Lord. And so could human beings. But some animals, clean animals, could be sacrificed. I think it's likely that that's how he spoke it, because certainly he knew the Pentateuch well enough, and he was pious enough, that he would never promise to offer a human sacrifice. And therefore, it's not likely that a man who was able to speak his mind in a clear way, as he did when he made that defense against the Ammonites, when he spoke to them, I mean, that was a man who knew how to put his thoughts in a precise and a logical argument. It's not likely he'd be so careless as to make a vow that would commit him to offer anything, including a unclean animal or a human, as a burnt offering, knowing as he would that that was forbidden in the Pentateuch, which he was familiar enough with. So I'm thinking that his vow should be translated without the and, but with the or. And therefore, he wasn't grieved that his daughter was going to have to be sacrificed as a burnt offering. He was grieved that she was going to have to be committed to perpetual virginity and he'd never have any offspring. And that is what's emphasized here, is it not? She went out to grieve her virginity, not her death. She went out to grieve that she would never be married and never have children and never give her father grandchildren and so forth. That's what she says in verse 37. Let us go out and wander the mountains and bewail my virginity. And when it says in verse 39 that he carried out his vow, it doesn't say he sacrificed her. It just says he carried out his vow, which he had vowed, and she knew no man. Apparently, it was her virginity that was vowed. She was apparently committed to serve in the tabernacle and never to marry. So that would be a tragedy that both she and her father would bewail because she was the only child. And that this would prevent him from having any lineage would make her sympathetic toward him too. She obviously was sympathetic toward her father. He was grieved. If she was going to be put to death, do you think she'd spend her last 2 months hanging out with her friends on the hillsides instead of with her dad? There was obviously affection between them. So I really just don't think anything about the story makes it likely that he sacrificed a human being to God. That would be an outrage. God strictly forbade people to offer their sons or their daughters. And again, you know, Jephthah is commended for his faith in the book of Hebrews. So I'm thinking that he, a man who is known only for such a horrendous deed as a human sacrifice would not be given as a great example of faith to us. So I don't think that's what he did. I think his daughter was not sacrificed, but that she was committed to perpetual service to Yahweh and therefore perpetual virginity.